fuck are we? Resonating throughout the hills, his call sounded like, Fugawi, and Sitting Bull said, from now on they will be known as the Fugawis. In the 118th, the Fugawi Award went to the company or individual staff officer responsible for the biggest snafu or screw-up of the week. John's would give a kind of humbling but often hilarious recapitulation of how it had gone. In this neat way, lessons were learned and admonishments given, but no one was hurt because it was all good fun. And fun was a necessary component in an otherwise painfully boring peacetime scene, particularly for combat units like ours. The 8th Division acted as 7th Army Reserve. We were way back from where the main fighting lines would be, and because there were airborne battle groups in the division as well, we vanguards would be the last to be employed. A year before, the 1st of the 18th had received the highest combat readiness rating in 7th Army. As a result, our role had become, theoretically, that of a general fire brigade, with all kinds of contingency plans and NATO responsibilities. As well, only a stone's throw from Heidelberg, Userer, and that great General Bruce Clark, we had more than our share of visiting firemen, which meant honor guards, parades, and jumping through flaming hoops on command. These created a lot of pressure, but on a nuts-and-bolts level, life in the 118th consisted mainly of training, practice alerts, and waiting for the east-west balloon to go up for real, or, if you were into that kind of thing, paperwork. The paperwork was enormous, with directives coming from DA, Userer, 7th Army, 5th Corps, Division, and Battle Group, all of which requiring answers, reports, and further implementing instructions. If a company commander chose, he could easily spend his time fighting this bureaucratic war and never see his troops at all. Swollen HQs, like the one I'd recently left, had nothing else to do. As they scribbled away their boredom, they did not consider the impact of their work down at the maneuver level. Personally, I refused to get wrapped around the axle in red tape from higher HQ, or in normal company administrative detail. I left it all to Big Ed Savetics, who was brilliant at this sort of thing, and stayed in the field instead, working to create some excitement and adventure for my troops while getting them prepared to fight a real war. Knowing how important food was to them, I often broke regulations and snuck my mess truck forward so a piping hot breakfast would be waiting when we got to the field. I had a great mess sergeant who converted the truck into a mobile diner. It reached the point where he cooked on the move and the boys could file through and pick up steaming coffee and huge sandwiches of scrambled eggs and bacon on toast, it sure beat cold seas, which they ate on the way to the LD. Often I'd call the mess sergeant in the middle of the last day of an exercise and tell him I wanted to surprise the troops for their job well done. I'd give him our ETA, and he'd be at the front gate to meet us, bearing a hamburger and a big bottle of German beer for every guy. No one had to pay. We always did this toward the end of the month when everyone was broke. Money came from our highly irregular, totally unauthorized slush fund. Monitored by Savetics, we generated capital for the fund by renting out our mobile mess as a snack bar to other companies when they were in the field. We also had an unauthorized company bar where the guys could go during off-duty hours in their fatigues for drinks, pretzels, and sandwiches. What was so good about all this, besides the obvious morale lift, was that it gave us the means to improve our overall life and times, throw an occasional party, and send guys off in style. No one had to go around asking people to chip in a buck to buy some guy a going-away present. Instead, through slush fund proceeds, I had little Company D Being There trophies made. It was just a small thing, this memento of our service together, but it did wonders for team spirit. Every few months, the 1st of the 18th went up to Baumholder, a former German training area north of Mannheim, and home to the 8th Div live firing ranges and maneuver areas, for a couple of weeks of field exercises. Baumholder was a dreary, desolate place that seemed to have a corner on rain, mud, and ragweed. Tim Grattan was my partner in misery there during hay fever season, both our allergies further aggravated by the dust kicked up on maneuvers. Neither of us could open our eyes in the morning. It sometimes took half an hour to soak the dried pus off before we could even muster a blink. But the battle group maneuvers were great. The old NCOs knew every fold in the ground by memory, and they were like Indian scouts. They seldom used maps and referred to objectives as the hill where Captain Holland got lost, or other event-tied coordinates. Colonel Johns, Natch, was magic in the field. General Grant of the Civil War was reputed to have had a somewhat simple captain whom he vetted all his orders through, figuring that if this guy understood, everyone would. Johns employed a Grant's captain, as it had become known, of his own, and as a result his operations orders were always clear and to the point. He also left the door wide open for questions if, for whatever reason, a subordinate wasn't sure of his task. "Find out what the goddamned mission is," Johns would counsel, "before you go slapping off the walls." It was a most welcome invitation. The average company commander, especially in the new gotta-be-perfect army, was one afraid to admit he wasn't sure. He might, perhaps, ask one of his peers for clarification or advice, but heaven forbid he should go to the source and be branded a little slow on the draw or just plain dumb on his next ER. Johns didn't give a damn about ERs. In fact, he was repulsed by what he saw them doing to the army. In the field, he just wanted results, and knew the only way to get them was to make sure his people knew what they were doing and got it right the first time around. One night on maneuvers, the battle group operations officer, newly promoted Major Sappinter, kept bugging me for my flag location. It was pitch black and pouring rain, and I didn't know where the hell we were except that we were still not settled in. "When we're set up, I'll give you the coordinates," I told him. The constant harassment on the field phone continued. "According to Battlegroup SOP," Sap boomed through the wires, "I should have had your report 30 minutes ago. You are violating Battlegroup SOP, Captain." I really did hate staff officers, even good ones like old Sap, whom I'd known since Korea. I grabbed the phone out of the hands of Robbie Robinson, my wonderful RTO. "Look, Major," I snapped, "if it'll make you happy, you just take the Battlegroup SOP and shove it up your ass, 'cause I'm not giving you a report on anything until I'm goddamn well ready." Next thing I knew, the phone sounded again, and through it came a slow Texas drawl. "Hack," the colonel began, "Sap here just told me about this little problem you've got. I think you might be being a little hard on him. What do you think? How about just stretching a poncho over your head, flipping on a flashlight, and giving us those coordinates so we can send them on to division? Colonel Johns, if you have a look at Clay Pigeons of San Lo, you'll see that the young battalion commander tells his regimental S3 exactly what I've told your S3. Seems to me that's following the real battle group SOP. Johns laughed. "It's mighty hard to argue with that, son. You've got your SOPs right. Get back to us when you can." The major, Johns, was very tired, and his temper was definitely showing signs of wear. He launched his attack without preliminaries. "Warfield, I'm Major Johns. Just how the hell did you expect my company commanders and my S3 to make you an overlay in the middle of this black night when there's krauts all over the place and no more shelter for light than the palm of my hand? In the future, before you go asking for impossible things, you better make it your business to find out what the situation is." When we came in from the field, Johns and I laughed about it again. Even though he cautioned me to think twice before blowing my top, he added that from his experience he'd concluded that in combat a CO will put up with just about any insubordination as long as the subordinate wins the fight. It made sense to me. But it wasn't for a few years yet that I'd know exactly what he meant. If Colonel Johns was an old soldier's soldier, our battle group chaplain, Father Francis Xavier O'Connor, was an old soldier's padre. This huge ex-football player Irishman drove around the battle group to give absolution and say mass in an unauthorized jeep, borrowed from the cav, with a machine gun mounted on the back. He could also drink and curse with the best of us. Still, only once did I witness even a temporary slip from grace, and that was one night at the Baumholder Officers Club. Father O'Connor played the piano and regularly led the battle group officers in rowdy sing-alongs. "I Just Want to Play Piano in a Whorehouse" was one of the tops on his and that other Irish lad, Tim Grattan's personal hit parade. At Baumholder, we were right in the middle of one such off-color little tune when the assistant division commander bustled in, chewed every one of our asses, including the chaplain's, and banned us from the club for singing Unbecoming an Officer. There are ladies in the club, he raged. We moved out, our heads hung low, but not before giving winks to the ladies who had in fact been humming, if not singing along as well. But how did the other ladies, the wives, fare throughout the days on end when their husbands were in the field? As well as possible, but all things considered, theirs was a pretty empty lot. Two dreams of romantic reunions upon our return were regularly shattered. So close yet so far away, well described life for the Company D officers' wives in Mannheim while we were home at Coleman Barracks. And the wives collectively, unfairly, I thought, hated me for it. Sure, it was my fault the carpool to work left at 0500, and it probably was my fault that we didn't knock off until around 7 in the evening. But could I be blamed for the fact that by the time we'd finished drinking a few beers and shooting the breeze, it was 10 at night before, "Hi, honey, what's for dinner?" rang out through most D Company apartments in Benjamin Franklin Village. We men just never stopped. Each evening we'd discuss the day's events. Then we'd talk about what we were going to do the next day and the next week. Sunday, the one full day off, was spent sleeping and gearing up to start all over again. I might have started the ball rolling, but now it was total gung-ho dedication on all our parts to make D Company the best rifle company in the world. Having such a tight group of officers did wonders for the morale of the whole outfit, but it took a hell of a toll on the home front. None of us consciously decided to lock the girls out, but there was a certain perverse pleasure in speaking in the silent shorthand we developed over many a beer. Dozens of signals, like the hand over the mouth, palm up, meant, "Say no more, you've said enough." A forefinger pulling down at the bottom eyelid meant, "I indeed know better." A forefinger on the nose meant, "Surely this guy's bullshitting," while our wives, oblivious, chatted away by our sides. So they shouldn't have married military men. It's a terrible way of life that never gets better. The job has top priority. The wife and family get what's left. The wife has to be a perfect woman to match up with and help advance her ambitious, perfect husband. She has to put up with loneliness. She has to be prepared to move at a moment's notice and at the same time have the old quarters, which were always too small for active little kids and by no means childproof, unscratched, unscuffed, and so clean that even the most tyrannical housing inspector with the keenest eyes and whitest gloves in the world could not level a statement of charges, hold up the move, and put the word out that she, and by extension her husband, was a slob. And should she manage to get away with max scores for housekeeping, all it meant was starting the same thing all over again in another billet identical to the last. The villages looked like serial German-made holiday inns. Quarters were close, 8 families per single four-storied stairwell, and on rainy days there'd be scores of toddlers racing up and down the steps. It was a wonder none of the mothers jumped off their roofs. Worst off were the newlyweds. Lieutenants brought home $220 a month, and with all spare change going to buy cribs and strollers for a kid, almost invariably conceived on the honeymoon, by the end of the month, husband and wife were eating cornflakes and powdered milk. And if by chance they weren't, or were driving a Chevy, wage-wise a captain's car, and not a VW, the gossip would begin. Everyone knew what everyone else made, and if a family lived beyond its means, well, someone must have a rich daddy. But the wives made do, scurrying back and forth between apartments, borrowing sugar, playing bridge, and solving one another's problems. Many got involved doing charity work. Others hit the bottle or played around, with word somehow always getting back to the cuckolded husband. I personally was my normal rotten self, having neither time nor patience to understand my family's needs. When Patty knocked out 2 of her teeth in a bicycling mishap, she rang me at work. My response was, "What the hell do you expect me to do? For Christ's sake, go to the dentist and don't ever call me at work again." Exo Ed Savedic's wife, Pam, was not really like the others. She was an ex-airline stewardess and a liberated woman long before it was fashionable. Every Wednesday afternoon, Ed had to go home and wax their apartment floors, or so went the word. We all gave him a hard time about it. What was a West Point Airborne Ranger All-American football player, U.S. Army stud, doing waxing the floor while his wife stood nearby with her arms folded across her chest? or so we imagined. Unfortunately, I had to give up my personal razzing. Ed was my neighbor at Benjamin Franklin Village, and our wives became good friends. Pam corrupted Patty into believing that she didn't have to shine my shoes or brass, a job I'd assigned her at the outset of our marriage, and that I could damn well do it myself. One evening I arrived home only to have the riot act read out, and Patty steadfastly refused to do this wifely chore ever again. How much nicer it would have been had she followed Colonel Johns's suggestion, offered up to the wives at one of their regular luncheons. "When your man comes home from the field, you should be at the door to meet him, martinis in one hand, your panties in the other." Unfortunately, it was a suggestion ably countered by Tim Grattan's wife, Darlene, who said, "Colonel Johns forgot one thing. By the time you guys get home, you're too sloshed to even know the difference." Among the top EM in the unit was my driver RTO William Robbie Robinson. Robbie was bold and fast behind the wheel of our brand-new state-of-the-art M151 Jeep, which was actually a death trap with individual wheel suspension and a tendency to flip over. I called him Sterling when he was driving, after race car driver Sterling Moss, and spent most of my time on the road hanging on tight and sucking up the seat. In the field, though, in his guise as RTO, Robbie was diligent, careful, and almost sponge-like in the way he soaked up the skills necessary to command and fight a unit. In this respect, he reminded me a lot of Don Neary, my RTO in the Raiders, who as a corporal was actually given command after Hill 400 when all the leaders were evacuated until Lieutenant Arvidson was found to take my place. No one had bitched, not even the more senior non-coms left in the unit. Everyone knew that Neary, because he'd been with me all the time, had the best know-how to keep the unit going strong. The relationship between commander and RTO is a unique one. In the field or in combat, a CO goes nowhere without his radio. As a result, he and his RTO are together 24 hours a day. It's a very tight relationship. Over time, an RTO knows his CO as a woman knows her man. This puts the RTO in a uniquely powerful position. He lives with the troops, and because he's usually the first guy to determine what you're all about, that is, if you care for your people or you're a phony, he can, with a few words, make or break you in his buddy's eyes. At the same time, because the RTO is in with the man, he often becomes the sounding board for the rest of the EM's bitches, who figure he can get through where they can't. I always tried to develop my relationship with my RTO on the order of, "Look, man, if something bad's happening, I want to know. If the troops are unhappy, you've got to tell me. I don't want names. I don't want you to be a squealer. But things ain't going to improve if I don't know what's wrong." RTO Robinson was just terrific. Eager to learn and fun to be with, even when conditions themselves were far from pleasant. One bitterly cold night on maneuvers, the battle group was fighting a withdrawal exercise through mountainous terrain. D Company was located on the Koppel. Our mission was to delay, deceive, disorganize, and deny the mythical enemy's attack, with my units to fall back on my order and not before. At present, everything was going smoothly, so Robbie and I were just sitting under a poncho on the hood of our Jeep, the motor running to keep us warm. I was exhausted. During maneuvers, you often went days without sleep. It was usually worse than combat. And now I found myself nodding off again and again. Finally, I told Robbie I had to catch a few winks. "Wake me if anything happens," I said. Sometime later, he shook me out of a sound sleep. "Come on, Captain, we're moving." "What do you mean we're moving? I haven't ordered the Koppel in." "Sir, I did it an hour ago." "You what?" "Sir, do you realize it takes a corps commander, a general, Robbie, to call in the Koppel?" How it worked was, if I felt the unit was under serious pressure, like about to be overrun, I'd call the battle group commander, give him a sit rep, and recommend the Koppel's withdrawal. He, in turn, would call the division CO, then that guy would call the Corps CG, who'd decide from the big picture whether it was time to pull in his protective screen. "I know, sir. We were under a lot of pressure on the left flank. I notified S3. I've seen you do it 100 times, and you were so tired I thought I'd go on and organize it for you. Now let's go." No one's indispensable, I thought as we drove off in the Jeep, though in the final analysis, Robbie had only been the replacement messenger boy, as Johns had put it to me on my first day with the 118th. In the old days, a company commander had full authority to bring in his outposts. Now, in the modern post-Korean centralized army, the fate of my 200-odd men rested in the hands of a lieutenant general 100 miles away. But who would know better? The company CO on the ground, who sees the enemy charging up the hill and knows it's time to haul ass or have his unit smashed and cut off, or a Corps CG who is so far up the chain of command he lives in a constant state of vertigo. Now and then, while waiting for permission to give an order to my troops, I contemplated whether I should try to radio my Aunt Frida in Colorado. She was no more removed from the situation we were encountering than the Corps CG was, really, and besides, it might bring some excitement to her life. "A systematic robbing of authority and prestige," Colonel Johns was later to write to me, describing the lot of company commanders and NCOs during this period, indeed since the end of the Second World War. Reports emanating from the post-war Doolittle Commission, calling in part for mammoth reforms in the selection and training of officers and in the relationships between officers and enlisted men, were largely ignored. With the introduction of computers in the 50s, the caste system Doolittle pinpointed became even more deeply etched in stone. Even among the NCOs, with the race for coveted supergrade E8 and E9 promotions becoming a ticket-punching exercise in itself. Then there was the Uniform Code of Military Justice, UCMJ, adopted in 1951, which robbed a company commander of the authority to administer punishment on his own, and certainly tied the fists of an old Army NCO. Since the UCMJ's inception, the use and abuse of the court-martial had become widespread. Personally, I sat on few court-martials. I had more important things to do with my time, like training my troops, and little by little, usually over a couple of beers, let the word go forth throughout the battle group that I thought any man up for a court-martial was guilty, and that any evidence produced on his behalf in an upcoming trial would not change my predetermined conclusion. This attitude generally led to my being challenged, so I didn't have to sit on the court-martial board at all. But few could completely escape the web of frustrated overreaction. Even Colonel Johns found himself tangled in it when one of the company commanders court-martialed a staff sergeant for being 30 minutes late for reveille, hence AWOL. This was the kind of thing that, in Trieste, would be dealt with by the guy's platoon sergeant, who'd say, "Do you want to work for me or the captain?" And 9 times out of 10, the transgressor would opt for NCO justice. That might mean a whole bunch of knights making little rocks out of big rocks with an 18-pound sledgehammer, but it also meant no bad marks on the guy's record. In this case, it was the sergeant's second offense, and the court-martial verdict that came down was bust him. Colonel Johns, who had made a rule about second offenses, had no choice but to uphold the finding. The E5, as a result of the bust, could not keep his wife and children on in Germany. Johns told me later it was the hardest thing he ever did in his life, and felt it never would have happened had authority not been wrenched so completely from the hands of officers at the company level. The particular irony of all this was found on the potential battlefield. While company COs could not take a piss without consulting higher HQ for the time, place, and manner in which to do it, in the field they were responsible for a staggeringly large defensive area. Our war positions in the event of a Soviet attack into West Germany were top secret, so secret that the maps were classified and locked away. We conducted recons without them, in civilian clothes, under the guise of picnickers. It was ridiculous, really. 4 or 5 white-walled American men in a field, having a picnic with binoculars and absolute military correctness, then strolling as aimlessly as possible, given our ingrained military sense of urgency, through farms and villages, selecting fields of fire and defensive fallback positions. When Tim Grattan showed me the battle group's war position at the Fold the Gap, I couldn't believe my eyes. My company front was 3 miles long. In Korea or World War II terms, regimental-sized, meaning 9 times bigger than any company front I'd ever held. The rationale behind it was, obviously, nuclear. In the Pantomic Master Plan, the enemy would be driven into killing zones, such as the Fulda Gap, at which point they would be creamed with tactical atomic weapons. Tactically, it was, in a word, crazy for European terrain and for anything less than a decision to begin total war. The army had backed itself into a damned-if-you-do, damned-if-you-don't corner, with those on the ground the ones who'd pay the price regardless of the chosen course of action. If TAC nukes were employed and general war followed, the risk was there for massive destruction of foe and friend alike, throughout all of Europe, if not on a global scale. If the U.S. powers that be decided not to use tactical atomic weapons at all, our Pantomic configuration, confronted by a conventional full-strength Soviet ground force, would only lead to the wholesale slaughter of friendly troops along the frighteningly thin battle line. The strategy was so weak it should have been disposed of hot off the drawing boards, along with the stupid and industrious staff officer/managers who'd cooked it up. Everyone at the top, and it filtered down damn quick to the junior officer level, was too busy doing to do any thinking, any real appraising or reevaluating. On one of our secret recons, we bumped into four young West German officers. They were not examining future war positions. They were not even on duty. What they were four totally professional soldiers on leave spending their time going over the ground of previous battles, studying, being reflective. Theirs was a serious interest in the business of soldiering, and one seen all too infrequently in the U.S. Army of the day. This was especially so in infantry, where being labeled introspective or studious was close to the kiss of death. Those words having become almost synonymous with distracted, lazy, or antisocial. Instead, we had, "Hell, will you look at that Lieutenant Wonder Boy? Isn't he moving? Boy, isn't he aggressive. What a can-do guy," with the admirers themselves moving and grooving at breakneck speed, unable to stop long enough to notice that Lieutenant Wonder Boy was actually like a dog chasing its own tail and never getting anywhere at all. The Pantomic structure lent itself particularly well to fostering a can-do, don't-think officer mentality, though the 1st of the 18th under Colonel Johns was an exception to the rule. The battle group concept ignored basic known principles of command and control and dug a huge chasm between the battle group CO and his individual company commanders. In the old organization, three rifle companies which made up the battalion were commanded by a lieutenant colonel. Three battalions, which made up the old regiment, were commanded by a bird full colonel. With the Pantomic concept's destruction of the regiment and the fattening up of the battalion, as it were, to become a five-rifle company battle group, a decision was reached to make the new battle group unit a full colonel's billet. The immediate result of this was a frantic scramble among thousands of infantry birds for about 80 battle group command slots, an essential step on the stairway to those stars, and an enormous gap in both age and experience between battle group and company COs. The longer-term result was that not only infantry majors but now lieutenant colonels too went without a command assignment. And though it was ideal for them in terms of time to run after their tails chasing degrees, DA staff assignments, and other essential punches on the old ticket, it meant that in the event of war within the decade, the Army would find itself with a generation of middle-level commanders who had little, if any, command experience beyond the company level. If this alone were not cause to make a student of the military a bit uncomfortable, there was the problem of span of control. Generally speaking, the known effective span of control for a CO is five subordinate maneuver elements. In the old organization, this worked just fine. A battalion CO would have three rifle companies, a weapons company, and maybe a tank unit as well. But in the battle group, a CO reached his optimum number with his rifle companies alone. Beyond these, he was responsible for the employment of the newly configured battle group combat support company, which included mortar, recon, AT, and radar platoons, and in the field, additional attachments such as an engineer company, a couple of tank companies, and an artillery battalion. So on the Pantomic battlefield, a CO could easily find himself with at least nine maneuver elements, well beyond the effective span of control for most colonels of the day. Of course, some COs, The ones who were calm, proficient at their trade, and well-versed in the ebb and flow of battle could handle that number and more. But they were the exceptions, not the rule, and I completely shared Colonel Johns's wish that the battle group concept die a quick and quiet death. The system had been devised by Chief of Staff Maxwell D. Taylor and many of his 101st Airborne protégés. Like others who held top spots in the Army, a lot of these men had made their names in a few months' combat in World War II and, through quick wartime promotions, found themselves as battalion commanders at the age of 23. They'd barely had time to experience life at the levels of platoon and company, and now they were the decision-makers, making authoritative, grandiose policies that, on the ground, meant life or death to the small units they were essentially ignorant of. Nevertheless, we dutifully looked over the war positions assigned to us, kept silent the thought that attempting to defend them against a Russian attack would be about as futile as trying to put out a forest fire with gasoline. According to Colonel Couch, the 1st of the 18th share of the enemy in a Soviet attack would have been 3.5 divisions, and once or twice a month had our enthusiasm and readiness put to the test through practice alerts. The alert would come at 3 or 4 in the morning. While the troopers and on-base NCOs jumped out of their sacks, a couple of off-post personnel would be informed. By roster, each of these men would call 2 more people, who'd call 2 more, and so on, until everyone had gotten the word to get his ass to his unit. By that point, the on-post NCOs would be readying the troops, and trucks would have arrived to provide lift for our rations, petrol, water, and ammo, all of which far outstripped the capacity of our organic vehicles. All equipment was kept in a state of readiness for these alerts. You never knew, with all the contingencies we had going, if it would be the real thing. Within 2 hours, we'd be at our war assembly areas, and while higher HQ inspectors clocked us in, a screwed-up practice alert could mean the end of a CO's career, and ran around checking to see that we were all there and had left nothing behind in our rear area. I'd make sure my boys got maximum training value out of the exercise by having them set up defensively, get camouflage on, and make out range cards. Company D was almost always fustest with the mostest at the assembly area, but I could take little credit for our consistently fine performance. My top-notch NCOs ran the show. All I did was walk around during the outloading, making my presence known. An organization does well only those things the boss checks, Bruce Clark always said. The first time I'd heard the adage was when the general had it printed on thousands of 7x5 index cards to distribute around Userer Command. I'd gotten mine in Nuremberg and loved it so much I'd had it framed, with the thought of hanging it in every office I had for the rest of my career. It was a simple and straightforward command philosophy I'd adopted for my own, and no one could say they weren't warned when out of the blue I'd arrive for a quick look-see and tear asses if things weren't up to par. Like the night out in the field when I caught 100% of one of my platoons sound asleep, no security on the line, no one even on the radio in the platoon CP when I stomped in there. I roughly shook the platoon leader awake and started chewing his ass royally. He scrambled out of his sleeping bag, and suddenly I forgot why I was so mad at him. I was struck dumb. This lieutenant, in the field, in a fart sack, was wearing silk pajamas. Suffice to say, it was an ass-chewing never to be forgotten. One of the most gung-ho of all the 1st of the 18th's regular officers was Lieutenant Tom Johnson of C Company. He was a fine stud, and so enthusiastic that we called him Ranger Tom. One afternoon, during a daylight training problem, Ranger Tom saw a uniformed Soviet officer in the distance observing Tom's platoon through field glasses. Johnson immediately went to ground and, with the finesse of my best raiders, snuck up behind the guy, tackled him, and took him into custody. Only then did he find out that the comrade was authorized, belonging to a military observer group based in Potsdam, which allowed the Soviets and the Americans to inspect and monitor each other's training and troop deployment. All of us had a good laugh over the incident, but with Khrushchev crowing about Russia's superiority in both nuclear and conventional war-making, it was little wonder that guys on the ground got a little jumpy. And for myself, I'd learned the hard way that it was pretty tough to trust anyone, After all these months, I'd received word that I would soon have to appear as a witness against Harold Borger, who'd been arrested while buying secret documents at the Nuremberg Railroad Station. It was a strange period of conflicting signals, not only between East and West, but within the U.S. Army as well. Know Your Communist Enemy dominated the troop information program, yet Major General Edwin A. Walker was admonished and relieved of his 24th Infantry Division command just down the road at Ulm, West Germany, for preaching impassioned anti-Red doctrine to his troops. Being the well-indoctrinated anti-communist stormtroopers that I and most of my friends were, we felt he'd been given a raw deal. After all, the Cold War was basically a war of words, and Walker had just gone in with all dictionaries blazing. Some months later, it came out that the two-star was a John Bircher from way back, and according to Secretary of Defense McNamara, had quite likely violated both civilian and military law by trying to sway his troops toward ultra-right-wing voting in the 1960 congressional election. Acknowledging Walker's sincerity of purpose in attempting to fight communism, McNamara's testimony regarding censorship seemed to assert that there was a time and place for everything, but with the Soviets and the Americans like two evenly matched prize fighters dancing and prancing around the ring deciding whether or not to take the first swing, now was not the time or place, nor would it ever be, except for the vote, for Walker or any other man wearing the uniform. The military establishment, said McNamara, is an instrument, not a shaper, of national policy. I continued to work a few nights a week toward that elusive bachelor's degree. It was not an easy task, since most of my time was spent in the field, and whatever was left generally went to temporary duty as an umpire out with other battle groups. I got a hell of a lot out of these umpiring assignments. I never knew what trick or technique I'd pick up to slip into my own kit bag, but they were a long way from satisfying the diploma mongers of the new army. Once again, Colonel Johns came to the rescue. If I were on maneuvers, he'd send me his helicopter, and Jerry Heilman, the battlegroup aviation officer and a good friend, would fly me to Mannheim and guard my steel pot while I went to class. 2 hours later, I'd dash out with the next week's assignment in hand and fly back to the field. Had I known that a world event was in the making that would effectively cancel any hope of finishing the degree, in Germany at least, no doubt I wouldn't have gone to the trouble, but my own ticket needed that punch. Without that smart guy foundation, my career was just a house of cards. In mid-August 1961, all of the 1st of the 18th's company commanders were assigned as umpires for Operation Wind Drift, an Army-Air Force joint airborne exercise, one of the largest of its kind held in Europe since World War II. Two 8th Division battle groups, the Airborne 504th and 505th, were marshaled in France. Those umpires who didn't jump in with them were to meet our units at the initial drop zone, DZ, in northern Germany. Whoever had chosen this DZ should have been put against the wall and dispatched with extreme prejudice. It looked as though it might have been an artillery range at some point, or maybe a convenient practice range for the old German anti-aircraft artillery school to which the field was adjacent. But whatever its original purpose, it was the last place in the world a person in anything less than a crusader's armor would want to drop. There were knocked-out tanks, trucks, and other obstacles all over the area. All had been carefully padded with mattresses, but you only had to jump out of an airplane once to know that no mattress is going to save you if you come down and land smack up against the turret of a tank. The terrible conditions on the ground were matched only by the lousy weather, and the drop was delayed most of the day. My great buddy Dick Coker, a fine young captain who was CO of B Company, joined me in the long wait at the local Gasthaus. It was late afternoon before we heard the buzz of approaching aircraft, indicating the drop was inbound. We hauled ass out to the DZ just in time to see one of the first guys come down, a West Point lieutenant who did everything right, except that he smashed right into a tree and broke both his legs. Soon Dick and I joined our respective assigned companies. The maneuver continued for a few hours, when suddenly a large army helicopter flew over the scene. "Attention! Attention!" we heard booming down from the PA system on the hovering craft. "All personnel from the 1st of the 18th Infantry report to this chopper." In the bird, we were told the battle group was moving out for some big emergency, but what it was, no one knew. Colonel Couch, who'd also come up for Operation Winddrift as its chief umpire, was equally in the dark. Of all the contingencies we'd been prepared to meet, none particularly stood out. We finally concluded that de Gaulle must have run into serious trouble in Algeria. This was just about the time the French Foreign Legion revolted, and we were going there. It was all very exciting. For weeks and months, I'd been telling my company we had to be prepared, and now it was happening. We were going to war. My biggest concern was how D Company, left to its own devices, had done in this real-life alert. Just weeks before, we'd gotten a new Topkick, an E-8 issued by DA. He was infantry branch, but had been holed up in some higher HQ for so long he didn't have any idea about what was what at the rifle company level. He was short and fat, and his uniform fit him like a duffel bag. He didn't look anything like a soldier. And though his name was Ball, his extreme fumbling from day one quickly earned him the name of Fingers among the troops. I'd fought and screamed to get rid of him, but to no avail. Even with Johns backing me all the way, DA wouldn't budge. My only recourse had been to make Sweeney my unauthorized field first. I had to. The rest of my fine NCOs were in shock with this new Jasper in charge, and as much as possible, leave Fingers Ball in the office with the company clerk. He was the first computer-issued ticket-punching top I'd ever had to deal with. It was agony just to hold my temper day after day. Logistics problems kept us at one of Operation Winddrift's CPs until 0200 hours, at which point we and our jeeps boarded Dumbo choppers and headed south. As we passed over the Autobahn, I saw a huge military convoy, close to 500 vehicles, winding its way north up the road. We arrived at Mannheim to be met by a calm and smiling Colonel Johns just as the last trucks were moving out from Coleman Barracks. "Hi, boys. Where have you been?" he said, grinning. "Looks as though we're reinforcing Berlin, so I want you to go home, get yourselves a change of clothes, say goodbye to your wives, and try to catch up with your companies. Hack, you're leading. Coker, you're next in the column." So we're going into Berlin, I thought, as I hurriedly packed my gear, hardly, if at all, noticing Patty's anxious eyes. I guessed it had probably been inevitable. The divided city had been a thorn in East-West relations since the moment it was created at the end of World War II, and in recent years, Khrushchev's favorite taunt, it seemed, toward the United States. It would be the third major confrontation over Berlin. The first, in 1948, arose when three of the four powers that occupied Germany, the U.S., French, and British, decided to unify their zones and rebuild West Germany within these borders. Berlin, similarly divided in the heart of Soviet-occupied Deutschland, naturally went the same way, much as the British and Americans had merged their forces in occupied Trieste when I was a kid. Thus provoked, from his point of view, Stalin began to close down all ground access to Berlin until there was none, effectively holding the citizens of the free part of the city hostage. The brilliant response on the Allies' part was simply to supply West Berlin by air, and for almost a year, that was exactly what they did. Beaten so beautifully at his own game, Stalin finally gave up and reopened the road rail access routes. In 1958, the whole show began again, with new Premier Khrushchev threatening another blockade if the West didn't pull its troops out of Berlin. To Eisenhower in Paris and to Kennedy in Vienna, Khrushchev made known his intentions to sign a separate peace treaty with East Germany, giving that host government control over the fate of Berlin. In 1959, Eisenhower stated firmly that the U.S. would go to war over the divided city should access to it be denied for whatever reason. In both clashes, the U.S. had listed the nuclear response as a proposed solution to the problem. In the first, the Americans were still the sole possessors of atomic weapons, and though this did not stop Stalin from imposing the blockade, it seemed to keep him from any further hostile activities when the blockade proved ineffective. In the second case, during Ike's administration, the risk of war over Berlin was once again nuclear. But this time it was for the simple reason that Eisenhower had gutted the armed forces of the ability to wage conventional war. The past months of the new Kennedy administration had been plagued with the problem of Berlin, and after the Bay of Pigs debacle in Cuba and talks in Vienna with Khrushchev that were no more productive than Ike's last round in Paris, Khrushchev minced no words, "We'll bury you," he'd said, the president couldn't afford to screw around. He needed to act decisively on this powder keg issue, and soon, both to regain face and get the message to Russia that he meant business. The first step had been taken in July, when Kennedy boosted military manpower ceilings by 100,000, increasing the draft call, and raised the defense budget about $3 billion to cover these and other preventative measures should Khrushchev decide to fight over Berlin. Our reinforcement seemed to be step two, but the question was, why? Coker picked me up in front of my apartment. We raced out of Mannheim and tore up the Autobahn. Finally, we caught up with the tail end of the steadily moving 1,500-man convoy. It was a formidable bunch, the entire battle group, plus artillery, engineers, and signal. All normal attachments were present, less tanks, moving smartly up the Autobahn in tactical formation 20 meters apart. We didn't reach the midpoint of the column until late in the day. There, the convoy had stopped, or so it appeared, dead in its tracks. The 8th Division CG, Major General Dolman, was there with his chopper. He and S-3 Sappinter joined Colonel Couch, who was with us, to discuss the problem. Apparently the military gas tankers that were supposed to refuel us on the move had failed to arrive, and the task force was now, vehicle by vehicle, topping off at a lone European Exchange Service EES gas station on the other side of the road. It was a snafu of the first order. Road guards had had to stop all southbound traffic while the entire convoy exited the Autobahn, filled up their tanks, and looped back across the center grass strip to continue the northbound trek. We found out later that tankers had been on the move, but some unthinking logistician from Division's G4 shop had sent them not from Bremerhaven, a logical choice in that they would have met the head of the column with time to spare, but from south of Mannheim and after the convoy had moved out. How anyone could have expected those huge mothers to catch up with much less double the moving column to give us the juice was beyond nearly everyone's comprehension. Meanwhile, Coker and I were getting anxious. We wanted to join our companies. Dark was falling. The bottlenecks at the EES station involved other units. Companies D and B were long past it. So we persuaded General Dolman to let us borrow his chopper and flew off into the failing light. The guys greeted me at Brunswick Airfield, where the task force would bivouac that night, with welcome smiles and even more welcome sea rations. Savetix, who'd been acting CO in my absence, filled me in on how things had gone since the alert. The company leaders, officer and NCO, had done well and handled the emergency like pros. I finally found out what had prompted our mission. After years of threats, Khrushchev had finally decided to act on his greatest problem with Berlin. Since the end of World War II, East German residents had been pouring from the Red Zone in flood proportions. The last decade alone averaged well over 200,000 per year, with the majority choosing the easy way out, Berlin, where freedom was just a few unguarded paces beyond the Brandenburg Gate. Such an obvious show of voting with one's feet was a huge continuing embarrassment for the Kremlin and the puppet government of East Germany. So much for the utopia of the communist system. So Khrushchev had decided to stop it once and for all. And while Kennedy and company planned for contingencies like another blockade of access roads into Berlin, Khrushchev and his gang pulled the plug from the other side. Overnight, the legally divided city became physically divided as well, with barbed wire and roadblocks strung along the entire 193-mile east-west Berlin border. Guarded 24 hours a day by East German and Soviet soldiers, this interim barrier was the beginning of the Berlin Wall, and early the next morning, we'd slowly make our way through the access corridor on East German soil to see it for ourselves. At the airfield that night, the battle group was, to a man, professional. Few commanders or anyone else got much sleep, not only because of the amount that had to be done in the way of briefings and organization, but through sheer excitement. We were sorely under strength. The division staff had arbitrarily decided that anyone with less than 30 days left on his tour was excused from the mission. But that didn't concern me as much as the rumor that we would not be going into Berlin with our trusty old M1s. Instead, went the word, at this 11th hour, all the men were going to be issued brand new M14s. The logic of this was beyond me. It was as if someone were already planning the post-mortem of a failed suicidal mission. No one can say they weren't armed with the latest and greatest. Maybe the powers that be remembered Custer, who declined the offer that his 7th Cav be equipped with the new Gatling gun to take on the Indians at Little Bighorn, confident that the red men wouldn't stand and fight, and wanted to be sure we had all the firepower we'd ever need. The only problem was that much of the battle group had never fired the M14. Some probably hadn't even seen one. My guys, who at least knew how to handle and fire the weapon, wouldn't be at any real advantage because factory-fresh M14s had no zero. And behind a weapon with no zero is a trooper, even an experienced trooper, with no confidence. It didn't seem the smartest way to go into a potential World War III situation, and I was not the only one who breathed a sigh of relief when the Helmstedt changeover did not come to pass. Johns had put the word out that when we jumped off the next morning, every man in the battle group would be clean-shaven and perfectly polished from helmet to boots. "I want you to not only be the best soldiers," he said, "but also look the damned best." Johns's particular measuring stick of soldierly appearance, and even more important, a barometer of unit discipline, was the steel pot's chin strap fastened precisely over the point of a man's chin. At 0400 Sunday morning, when he took a final look at his battle group, the colonel saw 1,500 walking recruitment posters in his very own image. Johns was in lead vehicle when we approached the first Soviet checkpoint. The crossing was without incident, and we began the 100-odd-mile journey through Red Territory. The day before, Colonel Couch had seen a Russian general and a few officers hurrying along the Autobahn in a sedan toward Berlin as if trying to find out what we were all about. Now, in every tree line, on every hill and every bridge, there was a Soviet or East German unit tracking us with the main guns of their tanks. All told, 110,000 East German soldiers and 20 Soviet divisions surrounded Berlin that morning. Suffice to say, it was a very scary ride. We were the vanguards, not just in name, but in fact, and sitting ducks if even one round was fired. Johns's last stand, I thought, remembering the colonel's remark early that morning. "We'll end up like Custer if those goddamn Ruskies take us on, but we'll take a goodly number of the sons of bitches with us when we go." I worried about my marginal soldiers. What if they panicked and opened fire themselves? Tim Grattan called and asked if he should set up mortars if we got hit. "Nope, just fight as infantry," I said as nonchalantly as I could, knowing full well it'd be over as soon as it began. Infantry in trucks was no match for wall-to-wall Soviet tanks. The tension was almost unbearable. Waiting, waiting, waiting. For an explosion, a shot, a something that would start the shooting match. Then I heard a roar coming directly toward us from the road up ahead. At first I thought it was a tank. The closer I got, I realized it was a twin-engined jet bomber flying about 60 feet off the ground. As it got closer, I saw its bomb bay doors were open. "He's too low to bomb us," I thought. "He'll blow himself out of the sky." But then, my God, he's going to strafe the column. How no one panicked in the face of this thing. Each of our vehicles had an air guard with an M60 or 50 caliber MG could only be attributed to the great training of the 1st of the 18th, or just plain old fatalism acquired of necessity, like Dick Coker's first thought when he saw the Soviet bomber. Well, they're going to take us out right here. But whatever the reason, not one shot was fired, and as the plane swooped over the convoy, we could see it was just a Soviet recon aircraft taking photographs. Bastards. Fine pictures could have been taken from 1,000 times the altitude, but the Reds just couldn't resist one truly provocative act. But then we reached West Berlin, and the enemy stepped aside. Swords remained snugged in scabbards. There was no blood, but the castle was under siege no longer. We, the vanguards, 1,500 white knights in trucks and jeeps, had saved the day. The people were overjoyed. As far as the eye could see were smiling, tearful faces, estimated later at 300,000 strong. Colonel Johns's jeep was immediately swarmed with Berliners throwing flowers and kisses. The cheers were deafening. I had to strain to hear the colonel's voice on the radio. "Hack, we're going to have a little march through the city now. You're leading. Now I want you to stand up on your seat and hold on to that windshield. Wave and smile all you like. Pretend you're Caesar going into Rome, you hear?" "Yes, sir." With that, Johns pulled up at a reviewing stand where stood Vice President Johnson along with West Berlin Mayor Willy Brandt and the high-ranking muckamucks of the Berlin Command, Major General Albert Watson II, U.S. Commandant, and Brigadier General Frederick Hartle, C.G. When Johnson, who had flown in for the occasion, had arrived earlier that morning, he'd received the same hero's welcome as we were getting now, and excited the crowd, in the best cowboy and Indian tradition, by hitching up his trousers as he got out of his car, a Texas symbol of determination, Stars and Stripes reported. Meanwhile, I stood up in my jeep as directed and led the parade through the cheering crowds. "So young," I heard again and again. I guessed they thought I was the so young colonel since I was in the lead vehicle and I knew I had to be on my best behavior. It wasn't easy. The entire convoy was, in Tim Grattan's words, up to its armpits in flowers thrown by the crowd, but we were also being bombarded with ping-pong balls and wads of paper. Why, I didn't know, till finally I caught one of the balls. Printed neatly on it was, "Mein Name ist Polly," or "Heidi," or "Gertrude," and a telephone number. Well, it's no mean feat to remain a composed and dignified liberating hero and collect flying ping-pong balls at the same time, but I gave it my best try. By the time we got to Andrew's barracks, Colonel Johns and the VIPs had already arrived. We unloaded, stashed ping-pong balls in pockets, and stood tall in formation. After the Vice President gave his welcoming address, Colonel Johns was asked to speak. Undoubtedly, everyone expected a corny old soldier talk, not knowing Johns spoke five languages. When he opened his mouth and poured out a beautiful speech in fluent German, jaws dropped open across the podium. Talk about showmanship. "That cool hombre," I thought. "He's probably been riding the thing since we left Helmstedt." We arrived intact and, besides the Petro fiasco, without a single hitch. Over the 435-mile trek, not one of our 491 vehicles had broken down, to the credit of the battlegroup motor officer, Captain Weaver, an Army aviator doing his ground duty hitch, and not one soldier had screwed up, to the credit of Colonel Johns. Now everyone just needed a little sleep. We weren't the only ones, though. Later I heard that 4,000 miles away, cadets at VMI, having heard their old commandant was leading the Berlin task force, had posted maps and tracked our route full-time for the last 2 days. A week later, a photograph taken of Colonel Johns at this tired time was published as a full page in Life magazine. In it, he looked exhausted and pensive, though still every inch a soldier. Some weeks later, a Life reader wrote in to remark that the colonel bore an uncanny resemblance to the subject of a Rembrandt painting called The Man with the Golden Helmet. We all thought this kind of spooky because, having scrounged around to find a copy of the Rembrandt ourselves, it was absolutely true. Johns designated D Company as the battlegroup's reaction force. As such, we moved over to Tempelhof Air Force Base, TAFB, the whole way across town from the rest of the battlegroup, which suited me just fine, and about 1,600 yards from the Friedrichstrasse border crossing, also known as Checkpoint Charlie. This heavily guarded crossing was the only access left between the two Berlins. Augmented by a platoon of M48 tanks and 9 armored personnel carriers, APCs, we were to be on a 5-minute alert, sleeping in full gear with boots on, ammo and load-bearing equipment stacked, guarded, and ready, until tensions eased in this showdown. TAFB had fine facilities, We were given a huge unused hangar, perfect for barracks, mess, and offices, with plenty of room left over for a complete indoor training ground. But before we all had a chance to move in, the base commander, an Air Force colonel, arrived to welcome us to his command and tell me he'd arranged for the D Company officers to stay at the USAF hotel, the Columbia House, nearby. As well, a new chauffeur-driven Mercedes-Benz was mine, simply for the asking. I loved that, not just from the personal standpoint, but for the international irony. There we'd be, joyriding in one of Western capitalism's finest works of art, right in the heart of a failing communist state. The following day, while the company rested, we officers took a general orientation jeep drive around West Berlin. We were begrudgingly escorted by members of the 6th Infantry, two battlegroups of which, the 2nd and 3rd, were permanent units in Berlin, who were incredibly jealous about the welcome we'd received the day before. Still, it was their job, and one of the first places they took us to was the wall. We got out of the jeep. The barrier was still a maze of barbed wire, but already concrete blocks were being laid for the permanent structure. A few West Berliners jeered and hissed at the robot-like communist workers and their guards. They were naturally ignored. The whole situation pissed me off.